This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by MintSim, the best way to get cheap 4G LTE data in the U.S. Use offer code ACFREESHIP for free first-class shipping on any MintSim purchase. Welcome back to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader, and this is for the week of October 12th, 2017. And the team is back. I'm joined by Andrew Martinick, who's trying to get over sickness over in Seattle. How are you, man?
I'm okay. It's just the change of seasons, it brings the crappy weather, and then it's just I don't know. It feels like half the city is coughing up a lung, and that's, you know, it may just be me, but I want to feel like I'm not alone.
No, you're definitely not alone. Jerry Hildenbrand, welcome back. How are you?
I'm freaking awesome, man.
Yeah, you are.
How are you? Right.
Must be nice.
I'm good. I was in New York yesterday and the day before for undisclosed reasons, and it was fun, but I ate too much and drank too much and slept too little, and you know how it goes.
As you do in New York.
And I enjoyed the hell out of it, but it also meant that I didn't really take care of myself, so I'm feeling sick just by virtue of not doing the regular things that an adult human needs to do to stay alive, like drinking water. I realized, like, this morning I hadn't had a sip of water for, like, 24 hours. Instead, I was drinking beer and wine and cocktails and other things. My life is not bad. I'm not, don't feel sorry for me.
It's mostly water and beer. So
oh, right. Yeah, that's counts. True. It really does just quench that thirst right down. I did try a couple good beers. I really enjoy going to New York because there are beers in bars there that are always interesting and non-standard. Like, I don't know about you guys, but if you go to a regular Irish pub in Toronto where I'm from, it's like six different beers on the menu, and they're all, you know, not, they're like domestic and they're boring and they're not really interesting. But whenever I go somewhere in New York, there's always like some are local, some are from like northern, you know, New York State, or even like local in Brooklyn or Manhattan. Like, it's really interesting. I don't know. Is that the case in Seattle, Andrew?
Oh, man. Oh, man. You got to come to the Northwest and talk about beer varieties at pubs. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the cool thing is, I think just like what you're saying is, if you go to like an Irish place, for example, like you said, you'll get local beers made in that, you know, kind of Irish style, but you'll also have two dozen other types of whatever else you want. It won't just, you know, stick to the theme.
Yeah, I mean, you'll find Guinness wherever you go. It doesn't matter.
Of course.
But you'll also have like a bunch of cool things that you probably never heard of. And then there's like Untappd. Like, everybody at my table was talking through their beers on Untappd. And that's been like this slow burner social network for the last 10 years or whatever, 5 years. And I don't realize that I use it. I just kind of like, I have a new beer, I open it up, and then I close it for the next 2 months. But super helpful. It's like Foursquare back in the day.
Except for relatively unhealthy.
it's okay. It's okay. YOLO. So, Jerry, did you get hit by the hurricane, Nate, as it passed through West Virginia?
We got probably an inch and a half of rain in an hour last night, and then it just stopped. Oh, I thought, oh my God, I better build an ark and collect some animals, and we're all going to die. And then it just stopped instantly. And I'm like, hooray.
Yeah, I think we're getting the remnants of it now. It's like 60-mile-an-hour winds. My house sounds like it's about to fall apart.
Yeah.
But I had to turn on the heat for the first time today. It's nice. Let's cozy up and talk about some tech, shall we?
By the fire.
Let's do it. Okay, so this week is sort of in between things. We're still waiting for the Pixel 2 to launch. We hear about, there's a Huawei Mate 10 announcement in Munich next week. I think it's the 16th.
The 16th.
Oh, yeah. It's a Monday. So, like, lots of things in the fire, but we're not quite there yet. And obviously with the Pixel, that only comes out next Thursday. And, you know, that's still TBD. Like, we know a lot about it, and we're going to talk about it a lot today, but it's based on our experiences still from the hands-on that's, you know, coming up on 2 weeks. But what we do know is quite a bit with the Google Home Mini. This is a product that they gave out to everybody at the launch event. And I think it was 2 days ago or 3 days ago now, Artem, the owner and sort of like super geek at Android Police, wrote this like in-depth experience he had with this
extremely
device.
In-depth, like down to the minute, here's what happened timeline.
And it was fascinating because what he's saying is that the Mini was essentially listening to everything he was saying. And it wasn't doing it on purpose. It wasn't, you know, always on. It was that the touch control on the top, where you can hold down, you can do it on the Google Home as well. You touch the top of it and it manually activates the OKG command, right? And this was happening all the time. And he went into his account activity and saw thousands and thousands of random inputs from his television, from snippets of he and his family. And it turns out that there was a bug where somehow this manual feature was just staying on all the time. So Google, as it does when it's at a crisis, sent somebody over to his house on a Saturday night or a Friday night, picked up the thing. I mean, the guy lives in California, so it's a bit easier than if it was like, you know, in West Virginia. But nonetheless, sends a person over, takes the unit, sends it back to the lab. The next day, he gets word that there's a software bug that, well, we don't know exactly what happened, but basically there was a bug that forced this feature to stay on. They disabled it temporarily at the time. And then, Andrew, 2 days later, we get an official statement from Google saying, actually, this thing is launching in under a week or just about a week. Mm-hmm. We're going to permanently disable this, you know, tap to hold OKG feature.
Yeah. And the interesting thing there is it wasn't, I mean, this was extremely proactive from Google as well. They started sending out statements to everyone who had, you know, commented on it, written on it. And they said, you know, unequivocally, this is just going to be disabled, not for a while, not, you know, temporarily while we figure this out. This touch to activate feature on the Google Home Mini is just no longer a feature. We're not gonna advertise it. It's not gonna be part of the literature for it and the, you know, customer service, anything like that. So the interesting part about this is, so this has to be a hardware issue. Really, I mean, there's no, because if it was just software, obviously they could push out an update to change how they, you know, how it works, just like they already could to push it out to disable it altogether. So you have to think it's something to do with, you know, because it's fabric instead of this hard plastic like on the Google Home, the standard one. So the interesting thing is that they're keeping the touch sensitive volume controls on the side of the Home Mini, and they're keeping the lights on the top so you can tell what's going on. But this is kind of Google trying to save face. I think you could pretty much look at it like that. They got kind of a little bad news cycle over this, which I guess is kind of understandable from, you know, people are already kind of on the, a lot of people are kind of on the fence about how they feel about having these quote unquote always listening speakers in their house. And this is not the kind of thing that you want to have, you know, the week before this thing goes on sale.
So Jerry, obviously, there are only a few dozen people, maybe 100, who have this thing in their home right now. Clearly, if, you know, Andrew's alluding to a hardware issue, and it does sound like it is a hardware issue. So, you know, Google had one of two choices. It could have done exactly what it did, or it could have recalled every unit that's about to go on sale. You know, I assume it's all of these boxes are already at Best Buy and every other retailer, they've stocked at Google's own distribution centers in anticipation of being shipped out. They could have recalled all these units, opened them up, and essentially exchanged them. But now it doesn't do that. So instead, it just doesn't have this one feature.
Very a lot of low margin devices, by the way, when you're selling them at $50, right. You're instantly going from black to red on each of these devices as soon as you pull it back. And the interesting thing is, really quickly, all of there is set up and learn how to use your home mini pamphlets in these things, right? That say that you could tap it to turn it on.
Right. Exactly. But I didn't really, this is not a well-used feature. The one thing that I use the feature for on the Google Home is to just mute something that's already on. So
right.
If I need to quickly, turn off a podcast or a song, I'll just go and tap the top of the unit. Presumably you can't do that anymore on the Home Mini.
Yeah, that's the one question I have for you, because mine is sitting here on the desk, not plugged in, because I already have two Google Homes within 20 feet of me. It seems to indicate that the touch panel on the top is just completely non-operational.
Right. Well, it's completely non-operational, but there are still volume controls on the sides that do the same thing.
Right, but you won't get the tap to pause, tap to turn off the alarm that's going off, etc.
Exactly. So this is maybe this is a big deal, but if you've never used that feature before, you don't even know it's there. This is the best case scenario for Google, right?
Sure. Well, it's the only thing they could do. They're not going to lose million plus dollars because they have to trash every unit that's been made. That's just not feasible. If it was something that made the units not work, that'd be another story, but this is a feature and they know what features we use. They're Google. They know everything. They know every time you've tapped the top and what it did when you tapped it. So I'm sure they looked and, people don't really use this feature on the existing Google Home, so let's just kill it. And then whatever's wrong with the hardware, it's just non-operational anymore and it's out of the equation.
So my question is, there's something that was raised by a commenter on one of our posts about this was, will they release a V2 of the Home Mini at some point? And they say, from this point forward, these models, we fixed the hardware problem. I don't think that they will, just because that's a bit of a weird dichotomy. Do you have V1 or V2 with the Home Mini and, that kind of thing. Do you guys think that they would do that?
Next year, they may make a new model that has the feature.
Sure, that was my response.
This one, they're not going to, as of October 12th, all the ones made with a date of, 10, 15 or later will be operational. They ain't going to do that.
Could be like adding the little nubs to the back of the Nexus 4 so it doesn't slide off your table.
Well, yeah, but that didn't create two different hardware paths or software paths.
True.
If one set doesn't have the feature in the software and the other set does, that's just a mess that's not worth it.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I mean, the one thing that I would say is there's a possibility that in software they could figure out a solution for maybe using the tap to pause or tap to activate using the volume control. So if I hold down on the right volume control for a second.
Maybe.
But that seems like it would be complicated. And I think this was a very, very quick decision. I mean, it's very clear that between Friday when this happened and today it's Thursday today, but this decision probably came in on Tuesday at the latest. That was a very, very quick decision on Google's part. And I have no doubt that hours and hours of agonizing debate went into this.
Oh, I'm sure. I imagine as soon as they got the report, people had to come to the office and suss it all out and then go to their boss, who then had to go to his boss, until they got to somebody that could just say, well, scrap it.
This is not a big deal in terms of the overall use of the device. And it's not a device that's under embargo, so I can talk about it freely. Mm-hmm. I like it. I think it's a very well-made product. Small, feature omission aside, it sounds good. It gives you everything that a Google Home gives you except for that base. If you're not all about the base, then you're fine. Or, as Jerry likes to point out, you buy a $35 Chromecast audio and hook it into a powered speaker,
right,
and those you actually have a really nice complementary system. Phil Nickinson and others like to point out that this doesn't have an auxiliary out, and that
I wish it
the
did.
Echo Dot has an auxiliary out. Some people even brought that up in the reviews of the Home Mini as a reason not to buy it. But I don't think many people actually use that feature. Am I wrong?
No. This, you know, taking away the touch feature on top, it's probably better. This is something simple that you just plug in and walk away from and never, ever touch again. You know, I'm sure you can change volume with your voice just like you can on the bigger one. It's something that you sit on the shelf or the table in your living room and don't fool with it anymore.
Yeah, this is something where, like I said, I have two Google Homes. One is on my bedside table that is mostly just an alarm and, you know, maybe listen to, you know, quick news or podcast in the morning as I'm trying to drag myself out of bed. The Home Mini could absolutely do that, and it's, you know, a little more than one third the price.
There are a few people. I can see Daniel wanting to use one as a whole house stereo, you know, get four or five of them with some speakers. I like to do that kind of stuff. Yeah, there's a very small market if Google were to make something in the middle between the Mini and the regular and the Max that just has a 3.5 output or, you know, optical, whatever. But I doubt that's a big enough market to spend the cost to design one, make one, and then distribute it.
Yeah, I know. And this will be a glitch, you know, a bump in the road on a pretty successful product launch. The one thing to keep in mind, though, is that the Google Home Mini is really not meant to be used as a music speaker. So I'm guessing it will be less disruptive. Like for me, when I'm using the Google Home, I have it in my kitchen, and I'm often listening to music loud while I'm making dinner. That's my primary use case for listening to music.
Mm-hmm.
Touching the top to mute it is helpful in that case because,
yeah,
if somebody's trying to talk to me, I can't actually hear them. Whereas with this, you're probably not going to want to blast music at full volume on it. So it's much less disruptive if you're just listening to a podcast or something. I know we're making a lot of excuses for Google right now, but I just think it this is not as disastrous as others are making it out to be.
No, and this, again, like you said, it's not the flagship device. This is supposed to be an entry point device. And I don't think that the lack of the touch on the top or any amount of small blip of bad press at the start is going to keep people from enjoying the core part of the Home Mini, which is Google Assistant.
That being said, you know, this is yet another instance where Google has had a hitch in its hardware product launch last year. They had a very hard time selling Pixels. Well, they didn't have a hard time. They had a hard time stocking Pixels. Every device that they've sold has had some sort of a, you know, minor hardware problem that people have just never let them live down. But from what it looks like, you know, everything else is going fairly smoothly. I put out a call to ask whether people are getting their Pixel 2s and Pixel 2 XLs like right at the at the announcement or at the launch date of October 19th, because I was under the impression that the XL was only shipping in November, right? And then I started getting people on Twitter telling me, actually, no, I'm getting mine on October 19th, October 20th, October 21st. So it does seem like, even though right now they're all out of stock because it's, you know, it's 8 days after the announcement.
Yeah.
It does seem like Google has a better handle on its, Pixel inventory this year.
They still have this problem where they won't just let you, you know, order one for a future date TBD. They still have this problem where they say, join a wait list. It's like, I really wish that they had a little bit more of the logistical, you know, chops and pipeline to just like take your money or take a hold on your money and ship it as soon as possible kind of thing. I'm sure that there's some reason that they can't do that if it's going to be more than 30 days or something like that. But I mean, my initial orders were for, October 20th, 21st, something like that, with express shipping. So, you know, at least some of them were able to come out at the same time. My bigger question is, like, this was always going to happen. Like, the initial rush, popular models go out of stock. Like, that was always going to happen. My question is, in, you know, by the end of November or something, you know, 1 month after launch, where does stock stand? You know, how easy is it to get one? Because the original Pixel just, it kind of came and went even 6 months later.
Right. Yeah, I mean, people were talking about how in March of this year, you know, 6 months or so after the phone had been announced and released, it was still very difficult to get some of the Pixel models.
Yep.
So, and this stands in like stark contrast to a company like Samsung, which never really has trouble selling, you know, stocking its devices, right? There may be a longer lead time between announcement and sales. In this case, with the Galaxy S8, it was what? They announced it on March 1st and then went on sale April 21st. So wait, am I fudging that?
No.
I think it was like 5 weeks. It was 5 or 6 weeks.
It was at least a month.
So in that, if that, you know, that's one way to do it. And then there's the LG method. Sorry to keep harping on LG, but then there's the LG method of announcing your device in the middle of summer, in this case, August 31st, and all of the V30 units or models in the US aren't even on sale yet.
I don't know what Google can do about that, though. If you, and Samsung is a great example here. In the beginning, you know, the original Galaxy S or the first Note, those are impossible to get. You tried to buy one, and it took you, they were out of stock for 2 weeks, and then there was a few of them for sale for a couple of days, and then they were all gone. And that's kind of the way manufacturing and distribution works. They can't ship 5 million of them at once. Heck, they can't even make that many at once because of the risk of losing money. But Samsung learned that if we can make more and we can sell more, we make more money. Yeah. Whereas Google's just starting here. I don't know, you know, if Google, I don't think Google can ever be a Samsung as far as selling hardware. I just don't think that'll happen.
I do think that people need to understand the kind of major logistical hurdles that you can't just overcome by the fact that, of course, Google gets less of a, they get a shorter leash because they're such a massive company and theoretically could throw billions of dollars at this, but they're not going to. They're still trying to figure it out, and just throwing money at the problem doesn't necessarily fix it. I remember right after the event, Jerry and I were talking, and we were looking at the same phones at the same time with the same shipping method, and his were 2 to 3 to 4 days behind mine because, well, there are phones allocated for the West Coast, and they're sitting in Southern California, probably in some distribution center. And there are other phones that are over in probably Kentucky that are allocated for that side of the country. And if, you know, if that model's not in mine, it's going to take a couple days longer to come from the other side of the country. You know, they're just logistical issues. But when I look right now, I go to the Google store and I spec out a Pixel 2 XL 64 gig and I can get it here October 30th. I mean, yes, the black and white one with 128 gigs of storage is not available, but you know, they're not all sold out and backordered 6 weeks.
I'm looking right now. Pixel 2 XL 64 in black.
I mean, that's the other thing. Like, while you're looking at that, Google, obviously this, we knew from months ago that Google and LG Display had a thing going, a fling, if you will. They invested $1 billion so that they could guarantee enough OLED displays for the Pixel 2 XL. And that probably led to LG getting the contract for the larger Pixel 2 as well. Because LG Display and LG Electronics are two separate companies.
Yep.
But they are in league with one another. And obviously, if LG Electronics gets a deal, then LG Display benefits and vice versa. What it looks like, though, is that Google also tried to diversify and split its liability here. So it has two separate manufacturing partners in this Pixel launch, and it seems like that's working. We don't know. I mean, it could be a month from now. It'll be impossible to get either one.
Sure.
But I don't think anybody had problems getting the black Pixel 2 shipping on October 17th in the U.S., you know, unless you ordered it like way later.
It also sounds like apparently nobody wants the smaller Pixel 2 and everybody's angry about it, but you know.
You think so? You think nobody's going to buy it?
Shoot, I ordered one the minute it was available, but everybody was like, just whoa, dead bezels.
Yeah, but we have problems. I'm talking about like the regular person deciding between the Pixel 2 and Pixel 2 XL.
Hey, it's for a lot of people, it's the only one they're going to afford, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, we can say how horrible it looks and people in comments can go crazy, but then everybody also says it looks like an iPhone. That's not a bad thing. Jesus, well, look at the receipts. That's not a bad thing.
Yo, dog, I've been using this Sony Xperia XZ1 for the last 5 days or so.
Oh, yeah. You know,
bezel-tastic, as Andrew knows. And I don't mind it at all. I think it's a fine device. And if you're justifying those bezels in some way, that's great. I mean, I think we talked about the shower test in the previous show, right? How if you can listen to your phone with no accompaniment, no Bluetooth speaker while you're in the shower, then the speakers are good enough. And the XZ1 passes the shower test with like flying colors. Those speakers are great.
Yep.
I don't even necessarily care about the speakers. I like having somewhere to hold the phone when I've got it in landscape.
I mean, this has a shutter button too, so you need somewhere to hold, like when it's on its side. So
and you're right. It may not be sleek and smooth and in one piece glass screen like, you know, the iPhone X will be or the Essential phone or whatever, but I don't care. I like having somewhere to hold it.
Yeah,
people are different.
That's true. In other news, OnePlus as a company, Jerry, is in a bit of hot water.
Yeah.
We heard over the weekend, we heard in the last couple of days, again, because this is something that came to light in January, but nobody really noticed. OnePlus, its analytics tracks what you do on your phone. But not only that, it takes it a little bit further. What are you hearing about this?
I hate what they did. They don't completely anonymize it because they're also collecting identification or data that identifies you. The phone's, you know, the phone's IMEI, the phone's serial number. This is OnePlus, the people you sent the money to buy the phone with the serial number they sent to you. If they have the serial number, they have your name. And I don't like that at all. Then we find out that it's opt out, but we've hidden the setting and the setting is labeled something completely different. And they're not trying to trick anybody. They just didn't want to bring any extra attention to what they're doing. And when it comes down to it, every other company except for Apple and Google and Microsoft does the same exact thing.
So what are they trying to learn from you when they capture this?
They number one, they want to, they look for hardware issues, software bugs. You know, if your phone crashes or apps crash, they get that kind of data, which is good. As you know, that's something reasonable. And they look for how you use your phone. Are you using your phone in long bursts, you know, like watching a movie? Or do you use your phone every 5 minutes for 5 minutes at a time? They want to get a handle on how people use it so they know how to set up, you know, battery saving apps and that sort of thing. They really want a profile of how everybody uses their phone so they can see what the most popular way of using the phone is and try to make it work better for that segment.
And if you get a hold of them and you start complaining about your phone having this problem or that problem, they have a better view into what's going on. They can actually help you with that.
What they're doing, I can't say that it's a bad thing. My biggest problem is what I would have liked to saw is you get your brand new OnePlus phone and you turn it on. The first thing you see is a big long list of what they're going to do and you're forced to scroll through it until you get to the bottom, just like Apple and Google do. And yes, that's a pain. We've all scrolled through those stupid things on our MacBooks. And, you know, I wish this thing was gone. But if you didn't read it, then that's on you. They've told you and informed you. And then you can not check the box and click no, and it doesn't do it. That would be ideal. But they didn't do that at all. They didn't ask you. They just did it and really didn't tell you how to turn it off. That's wrong.
Well, it looks like you can't turn it off without using a command line function.
Yeah, you can turn off part of it. So you can turn off the join user experience program.
Which is some of the most invasive stuff.
Right, but you cannot turn off everything.
The user experience program is the one that tracks your apps and what you do in those apps.
So the issue here, Jerry, is that it's not necessarily that they're tracking what you're doing. It's that they're not anonymizing the data.
Yeah, that was my big issue. I think Andrew knows. I think I said that about 100 times when we were talking about the problem. That's, man, it doesn't help you any to know, you know, me. If you're looking at the apps that a user uses and how they use them so you have that data to try to make those apps work better, that's great. You don't need to know that Jerry was using it. That doesn't help you in any way. And that's something that I just hate.
So what can OnePlus do about this? Is it just enough to stop this program or, you know, obfuscate the IMEI and serial number? Or is this a program that OnePlus needs to kind of shut down and relaunch with a bit more transparency? What would you like to see done?
I would like to see everybody get a software update that shuts it off and then a pop-up when the phone restarts after the update to explain to you what they're going to do and how you can enroll in it and how it benefits them. I mean, that's a big reach. I don't think we're going to get that. That's ideally what I would like to see. If they have a reason that they can't anonymize or don't want to anonymize the data, tell me. Let me decide. I'll help you if I think it's worthwhile. I mean, I got a Google Home sitting here beside me, and I know that, you know, that's just a huge data mine as well as, you know, a product that's useful to us for Google. It's a giant data mine. And I opted in. I get enough out of it to let them, you know, listen. I just feel that we need to know more. The transparency.
I think that's what it comes down to. A company like OnePlus that prides itself on having a direct relationship with its very loyal user base is doing something that is perceived to be sneaky and yes. and in some way insidious because it's stealing. It's stealing from you. I mean,
yes.
I do think it's a form of theft. They're not disclosing what they're doing. And I know that sounds dramatic, but it's true. And it's not that this is just on the OnePlus 5. This goes back all the way, it looks like, to the OnePlus 1. This person whose data was collected was looking at this program on a OnePlus 2. Now, the OnePlus 2 is stuck on Marshmallow. It famously didn't get updated to Nougat. And it would be interesting to see whether we could reproduce this or even find more information about it with the OnePlus 3, 3T, and 5 running Nougat.
We did a quick look at Andrew's, what was it, the 5 or the 3T that you used, Andrew?
Both. I reset a 3T and a 5.
The app is there. It's active. It's on and collecting. We didn't hook it up and Wireshark the data packets and see exactly what it's doing and where it's sending it. We didn't have time to do that. But the app in question and the processes that app are running is the same as what this guy reported on the OnePlus 2.
Okay, so before we move on, this is a company that has been caught out and called out again and again for subversing standards within the Android community.
Yep.
With, I think, the important part, a customer base that is generally more technology savvy than your other manufacturers.
Right.
Absolutely.
And this is a company that was caught out doctoring benchmark scores. thinking that it could get away with it. And then they came back and said, well, we're not doctoring anything. We're just optimizing your game experience. We're making a choice to cut down on your battery life slightly by changing the governor of the CPU and GPU when you start a game. Except that's not entirely true, because what ended up happening was that they whitelisted a whole bunch of benchmarking apps to do the same thing, so that they would get much better performance in benchmarks, synthetic benchmarks that really don't have any real world effect.
The worst thing is that, and the data collection, Samsung does the same thing.
Everybody does the same thing.
Yeah. I use Samsung as the example. Samsung is Android. They need to take responsibility almost as much as Google does, because they are the hardware partner. Without Samsung, we don't have Android. And Samsung's user base is so different, Samsung gets away with it.
I guess Samsung doesn't explicitly do these doctoring things. I mean, nobody's doing them anymore.
No, Samsung got caught doing exactly the same thing, whitelisting benchmark apps to clock the CPU at its maximum. And that's not a big deal. I mean, you know, heck, I know Dell and HP do it in the desktop market. So, you know, that it's not like it's unheard of before. But, you know, they some companies can get away with it because they don't have the users that OnePlus has that care about every megahertz in that CPU. They are,
right,
you know, enthusiasts to the max. That's what put OnePlus where they are today. They should know better.
Hopefully this will be resolved shortly and OnePlus will issue a statement and everything will be hunky-dory. But it is also important to know that every phone manufacturer does this.
Right.
Data collection to some extent. Some are better at anonymizing the data than others, but what you do on your phone is not a secret.
I reset a couple phones here recently. I can tell you that, you know, we all know, I think everybody who's ever turned on and signed into an iPhone knows about the warning you get first. The Pixel will give you the same thing. You enter in your Gmail, but before it sends any data or asks you for a password, it tells you. It tells you everything that Google's going to do and asks if you're okay with it. HTC does it even a little better. HTC, the first thing you see is about the HTC experience, whatever they call it, where they will, you know, take data of how you use your phone to make the next phone better. So that's something that I would have liked to seen on the OnePlus. Just let us know.
Yeah, I think that two different arguments are being conflated here. When I look at, you know, what some of the responses on Twitter and in our comments are, they're conflating the, you know, should any manufacturer be collecting this kind of information, and do we hold OnePlus to a different standard? And at the same time, kind of, no matter what the manufacturer is, shouldn't we have more transparency about it? And I don't want people to say, as I think sometimes we've been a little guilty of, is saying, well, all of these manufacturers do this. It's like, yes, that is one thing that is separate from the fact of maybe we should expect a little more transparency.
Right. The fact that all of them do it makes it worse, not better.
Right.
And Daniel said something, you know, about this is theft. I've been saying for 2 years that data is currency. In 2017 and forward, your data is currency. And this is stealing, and I hate it.
I just look at all these other companies that are, you know, subsequently found out. I mean, remember what AccuWeather was accused of a few weeks ago? And I don't think we touched on that, but AccuWeather had an SDK built into its iPhone app that was sharing location data with a company that had a business model around selling your location data, anonymized, granted, but your location data to other companies for competitive, you know, business reasons. Mm-hmm. This is it's kind of like the dark web of data collection, right? We don't talk about it, but it's monetized.
I mean, people rag on me. That's one of the reason why, Jerry, which is the best phone I should buy? Well, it's either going to be a Nexus, now Pixel, an iPhone, or anything made by BlackBerry. Why? Because they do not sell your data. They tell you up front what they do with your data, and they don't sell it. Every other company sells it and shares it, and it's crap.
But that is an interesting point that, well, you could buy a Pixel, but if you, you know, install AccuWeather or whatever other app, it doesn't even matter what agreement you agreed to when you started up your phone.
Absolutely.
And then there's the whole thing around companies like DT Ignite that are that partner with carriers to push services on you. It's not quite the same thing, but these are practices that make carriers, make manufacturers, make app developers a ton of money. And in a market where everything is free, right? Whatever you download is generally free, and every service that you rely on every day is free. This is the consequence. And it's just worth reminding yourself every once in a while that that is the way the internet works.
Right. I mean, and there's, we already have two shining examples of how to handle that. You have Apple, which collects all this data, and they say, hey, we don't sell it, we don't share it, we don't let advertisers use it. We collect this data so our products are going to be better. If you don't like it, put this back in the box and take it back to the Apple store. That's great. And then you have Google that we collect all this data and we don't share it, but we use it so we can target you with ads. They tell you right up front what they're going to do. And it's ridiculous that we have to guess what other companies are doing.
Right. So it's interesting. People say Google is evil because they sell your data. And you've written about how that's not entirely true. Google does not sell your data.
No, it would be worthless if they sold it.
It's way too valuable to them to sell
it. It acquires your data and uses it for its own purposes. But Google is an advertising company. It's baked into the product. It's baked into the business. But when you are tricked, I guess, by a company whose public business model is to provide you a weather app, then that's where, you know, there's this cognitive dissonance. You can't quite wrap your head around it. Like, why is the weather app that I open 5 or 6 times a day actually making money off where I go, you know, in the city? That, I think, is the bigger problem.
Well, look at what Uber did. Uber wrote an application, and I'm sure it's been fixed by now, for the App Store for the iPhone, and it was set up so if you were more than 30 miles away from the Bay Area, it did extra things and took extra data. But if you got close to Apple's headquarters where the people that checked apps were checking the apps, it didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So there,
that is just plain,
it's disgusting.
It makes me smile how evil that is. Like, it's like pure evil genius evil.
Yes.
And that is, like, this is Uber's business model. But I mean, we've also, like, this is so not where we started, but it came to light this week that Apple actually gave Uber a special private access to a special private API that no other developers had, that allowed them to take screenshots and record video of people's phones, even when the app wasn't open, so that they could diagnose problems and try to offer remote solutions for users.
And I would really love to know how they talked Apple into that. Hey, Apple, we want to make our app be able to record users' voice while the screen's off, or while they're using it, take screenshots of what they're doing. How does anybody at Apple think that's a good idea?
I mean, look, like, before the app that you mentioned, the one that didn't share data with Apple when the drivers were in, when the users were in Cupertino, before that happened, I believe that Tim Cook and Travis Kalanick had a pretty tight relationship. Like, if you think back to the rise of the App Store, Uber was a very integral part of that rise, right? I think it's 2012, 2013. Like, when we went from talking about millions to billions, of users or of downloads, like, Uber was right there, and it was one of the ways that people, that was the reason people bought iPhones before Uber was available on Android. Like, having an Uber app was, it's magic. You know, you call, it makes sense. But
I just don't see. I get flustered when we talk about this stuff because it makes me so mad I don't smile. It makes me so mad I want to slap somebody.
You can smile while you slap somebody.
Yeah,
they're not mutually exclusive.
I can understand why the people at Apple, especially the marketing department, were proud to have Uber as, you know, such a big part of their platform as they were. Uber is the cool new service. We've all used it. It's convenient, it's easy, and it's fairly cheap. And everybody loved Uber, and the best way to, you know, do Uber was with an iPhone. I can see that, but that's still, I just can't see somebody greenlighting, letting them access, you know, this stuff. And, you know, like, you can uninstall the app and it's still resident and tracks your location and that kind of crap. That's, I don't know how that got approved.
There's a lot of things about the Play Store and App Store business models that bug me. Like,
yeah,
when I open my Play Store app today, I noticed that all the new and updated games are free to play, match three, ad heavy, terrible clones of Candy Crush, which was already a clone of another game. And they're all the same, and they're not interesting. They're not creative. They're not unique. And Google has an app discovery problem.
Yes.
And
you would think they would know how to let you search for apps.
It's bad, and I just find it really
interesting. Well, it's a whole lot better than searching for apps on the iPhone App Store. I mean, talk about bad search algorithms. But they have the same issue. Too many apps, too much duplicate crap, and really hard to surface what you might actually think is good.
Right. And there's this overemphasis on free-to-play and in-app purchases. And it prevents really great indie developers from coming to the to the front and all that good stuff. But, you know, that's not really...
That's partially our fault, especially the free-to-play, because I don't mean our as in us three. I mean our as in everybody in general. You don't want to pay $2 for an app. That's what that comes down to. We wouldn't have so many crappy apps with crappy ads, and you end up spending $100 in in-app purchases if we weren't so damn stingy and would buy the app.
It's true. So last aside, my wife and I went up to a cottage with some friends over the weekend. It was Canadian Thanksgiving, and we played this board game called Blockus. You guys ever played Blockus?
No.
I'm not.
It's amazing. It's like Tetris, but on a board. And okay, it's super fun. And I obviously looked up the mobile version of the game afterwards. And the free-to-play game has like a 1.8 star rating or whatever. 1.8 rating. And it's because every two turns, there's a 15 to 30 second ad.
Oh my God.
Every two turns. And there are dozens, like 30 to 40 turns per game.
See, that app would last exactly two turns on my phone.
It's horrible. And I'm just like, I was amazed at how some, and this is Mattel and Magmic. Remember Magmic? That like early free-to-play game developer that started out on the BlackBerry?
Trying to remember where I heard that name, yes.
And they've now transitioned into free-to-play games on Android. They were like one of the early Java, you know, they pushed like those really easy Java games on BlackBerry. What's the block game that came on every BlackBerry 7?
Brick Breaker.
Brick Breaker was developed by Magmic in Canada, in Waterloo. So yeah, it was very interesting. Anyway, so not what we started talking about.
No.
But the cookie crumbles. Mm-hmm. Let's get to a couple of kind of like the featured meaty stories this week. Andrew, Duo.
Yes.
Let's talk about Duo. So
I could call you on Duo right now. We could do a little, get a little video session going here.
We'd have like an echo of our conversation in the background.
That'd be great radio.
It's so much, so good. Duo is being integrated into the Dialer app on Nexus 5X and 6P and Pixel, right?
And Android One phones.
And Android One.
Yes.
So this is a very interesting chain of events, more because it's Google really trying to get people using Duo, but also because of something called video over LTE. Tell us a little bit about what the deal is with Vilti.
Yeah, the announcement of Duo coming to these phones built into the dialer was kind of it sounded really cool. And then the back end of it, when we started learning about how it was going to also integrate with carrier services, made it a lot more interesting. So as we all kind of know about and then forget about, all of these carriers have their own. It was a few years ago, they really tried to start pushing having video calling integrated into the dialer. I remember most Samsung phones, LG phones you get from carriers, in the dialer, you would have two buttons. You would get a video call button and a regular call button. And it was kind of clunky, and it only worked when you called somebody on the carrier that also had a phone that was capable of video calling. So as you'd expect, nobody used it. So having Duo be part of the Android Messages app, Contacts app, and Dialer, you just get an option to tap video call. And so the interesting thing is that it'll connect it over Duo if you're not on a carrier that supports video over LTE, which is, you know, questionably useful, I guess. But if you are on a carrier that supports video over LTE, and so is the other person, which again, not a huge number of people yet, but anyway, stick with me. I swear this is interesting. You will connect over the standard protocol of video over LTE, which is kind of the next level of, we all talk about Vilti, voice over LTE. This is kind of the next level where carriers can integrate this as part of their standard network stack, their standard calling stack, where the video calls, just like the voice calls over LTE, are held on a higher quality of service standard, and you know, they're connected faster and they're lower latency and all that kind of stuff. The real core issues of video calling up to this point is that they didn't have that network priority. And it really, I mean, if anybody's used Duo, they know it's actually pretty good compared to other video calling systems.
Oh, Duo's great.
The technology is incredible.
Because they have really good codecs and they know exactly how to gracefully degrade video quality and save data and all that kind of stuff. And so that means you get this really short round trip on video. And so the interesting thing is they're saying that Duo and video over LTE can be used kind of interchangeably a little bit because, you know, it's just built into the dialer for these phones. And so carriers that use video over LTE are T-Mobile and Verizon that I saw in the US, and I know that SK Telecom in South Korea, of course, has just been using it forever, and they actually do like group video calls and all kinds of crazy stuff like that over just the regular cell network with regular phones.
Of course they do, because like everything in South Korea is like living in 3017.
Exactly. Well, the nice thing about SK Telecom is, you know, you can get insane data speeds anywhere in the entire country, so there is that. But so The going back to the Duo part of it really quick, the problem here is that, yes, it's just there and you could tap video call, but it requires that you and the person on the other end had set up Duo already. Now, modern Pixels, Android One phones, they all have Duo pre-installed, but there's no way that anybody has ever opened it because there's just this barrier to entry that nobody's going to sign up for it. So this whole thing of falling back to video over LTE, which doesn't require any sort of a pre-setup authorization, anything like that, makes a huge difference. So there's even though not a lot of people have video over LTE because of their carrier is not available yet, there is a way better chance that your carrier is going to get up to speed in this case than you and all of your friends and family are just going to start signing up for Duo out of the blue.
what Google did with Duo is, I'm sure, even if you're using the carrier network and not, you know, the data network and transferring it the old way through Duo, but if you're actually using video over LTE, the same tech that runs Duo is certainly decoding the received video and encoding and compressing the sending video. So there's no work for the carriers or the companies making the phones.
Yeah, so that's kind of the pitch for video over LTE, is that since you're already doing voice over LTE and this is a standardized protocol, it's not going to be some big amount of overhead. Like, no, you just have to implement this on your network and then just let people do it. Just like they already tried to make a big deal out of VoLTE and HD voice and all that kind of stuff. And we know HD voice calls, VoLTE calls sound amazing.
Yes, and they're incredible.
So this is going to be, obviously you have other barriers, like, you know, do people really make video calls all that often, that kind of stuff. But the technology is here, and this just kind of came out of nowhere. It's a surprisingly smart move from Google to try to integrate with video over LTE.
Well, it's this. Google has to get a FaceTime app. They have to get an iMessage and a FaceTime.
It sure ain't Hangouts.
And they are trying everything. The Hangouts could have been, but it was so damn complicated. And it was, you know, from the first day it released, it was too complicated for people who don't listen to podcasts about Android. And those are the most of the 2 billion that are out there. They're stuck.
This is what the move yesterday brings up. It brings up FaceTime, the promise of Apple's open source, you know, FaceTime back in 2010. You know, iPhone 4, it has a front-facing camera. We're launching with FaceTime. We're going to open source it. It's going to be available to everybody. That never happened. So, cool.
And it ain't going to in the future.
FaceTime is a big deal. It's used by millions of people. Whenever I do a remote hit for a TV station in Canada on my iMac, they ask me to do FaceTime because it is so reliable. It's more reliable than Skype. You know, we've talked about Skype. Skype is a bloated mess. Microsoft has done what it could with
it. Especially on mobile.
Ugh. It's improved everything about Skype, but Skype was built as a peer-to-peer messaging service, and it got completely renovated a few years ago. From the bottom up, it took like a year to transition everything to a centralized messaging and video chat service the way that, you know, most others are today. But Skype is just not reliable. And there are very few other video video chat services that are not hard on your data network and hard on your on just like low quality in general. Duo is fantastic. Yeah. It scales really well. It's lightweight and it just works. It works everywhere. And I remember back when Google launched Allo and it came out, and everybody who didn't have Allo, you could message anybody in your contact list. And if it didn't have Allo, they would get a text message sending them to the download link for Allo. This is kind of like that, but way less invasive, because I think people actually need a second or third video chat service. They don't need a ninth or tenth text chat service.
But to that point, I think that the interesting thing about Duo being integrated into other services is people aren't really going looking for video chat solutions. It needs to just be just this utility that's built into what you already do. Trying to get millions and millions of people to go seek out Duo was just not going to work. Having it integrated into how the phone works is the only way it's going to take off.
Right.
The only way it'll take off, at least in North America, is if they can get FaceTime and Duo to be interoperable over the carrier network. And that's never going to happen. Never. But Apple will never let FaceTime work with video over LTE.
I mean, this sounds sort of like RCS in a way, where Google is working with carriers to integrate or an upgrade basic texting. This is just better. It's like better voice calls It's voice calls with video.
Yeah, the solution is easy, but impossible. Every Android phone baked into the operating system is Google Messenger with Duo built in. And if Samsung or LG or whoever doesn't like it, tough, don't use our software. But that can't happen. That can't even get, they couldn't even get away with that in the US, let alone, can you imagine what the EU would do to them?
Huh. So, and interestingly, I mean, Duo has just straight audio calls too. I mean, this is what we've been wanting forever
Duo
Hangouts.
Duo is FaceTime, man. It's easy and it's great. And the problem is nobody uses it. Everybody with an Android phone that's what, I think it's Lollipop or higher, you should be using Duo. It's amazing.
You must make video calls with your daughter and grandkids.
Yes, I do. My daughter, my wife, Duo, and we use Allo too because, you know, I still text people and I kind of sometimes wish that Allo was like a simple version of Project Fi's Hangouts where everything could be together, but it's not. But Allo is great too. I mean, I've tried, I don't use WhatsApp now, so don't try to message me dirty pictures. I've tried it, Facebook Messenger, they all suck compared to Allo. Everything sucks compared to Allo except iMessage. But nobody uses it.
Yeah, and it relies on your phone number, all that stuff. Google has a problem.
And the big question is, if it relies on your phone number, why can't it send texts? And the only people that have the answer to that question haven't told us why. But I'm sure there's a reason, and I imagine it involves angry people at Verizon and T-Mobile and Samsung and Sprint saying, no, 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 but we don't know why they're saying no.
So we're talking about lack of cooperation, right, on so many levels. But this week we got an example of, you know, cooperation in the most consumer-friendly way. And this is in the form of something called Movies Anywhere. And it launched today, October 12th, and it's really interesting. So we'll take you through it. It's based on a technology that Disney created for itself back in 2014. It launched called Disney Movies Anywhere. And it allowed you to claim ownership over digital versions of movies that you've bought on one platform or another. So if you bought the Little Mermaid on iTunes, and then you saw a special, or you move over to Android and you bought The Lion King on Google Play Movies, you'd have to go to those separate players and platforms to watch them. Whereas now with Disney Play Anywhere, they negotiated with all the different platform owners, Roku, Vudu, Amazon, Apple, iTunes, and Google Play Movies. And you can now watch any of those shows or any of those movies on any platform you want.
With things that you had purchased previously, too. It's not even just going forward, which I thought at first it was.
Right.
Right?
Yes. And
that's the surprising
fantastic
part to me.
Oh, that's the way it should be. You already bought that stuff.
Exactly.
It sounds
but
so
that, up
common
to that
sense.
Point, up to this point, it had not been like that in any way.
And it's surprising to see, especially Amazon and Apple, who do video very well. Their customers that use iTunes or use Amazon Movies, they're very happy because the service is great. To give up that kind of control, it was surprising.
And those were ones that were traditionally very tight.
Yes.
I don't know what they were not very happy about putting their content on other platforms. I mean, there was no way to get your iTunes purchases on an Android device.
So what's really interesting is that with Movies Anywhere, Disney negotiated with almost every single major movie studio except for Paramount Pictures and Lionsgate. So there's Fox, there's Universal, there's Warner Brothers, and
Sony?
Basically, I'm not going to say every movie. I think I saw one of our colleagues at CNET, Scott Stein. He has kids, and he said he bought 151 movies from between his all the platforms, and about 101 of them were available on movies anywhere. So 2/3, which is a pretty decent number for a service like this.
Yep, that's, and it really paints a bad picture of Paramount. You know, if you have Mission Impossible and you bought it on the App Store and you buy an Android tablet or a Fire TV and you, I'm going to watch Mission Impossible. Wait, I can't. Why? And then you investigate and you see, well, Paramount's holding out and they want you to buy it twice.
So according to the reports before this launched, Bloomberg said that Paramount isn't saying no, it's just holding out for a bit more money. And, you know, I'm so done with big companies holding out for a little bit more money because that's prevented so many great products from launching. But at the same time, Disney, if any company was going to do this, it's Disney, right? Disney has so much influence over the industry. It's been the behemoth that has not screwed up the big brands that people love, right?
And they're deeply tied. I mean, they're board of directors at Apple and Google, and I know they're involved with management at Facebook. Disney is part of these tech companies as well. Disney executives know, you know, they know the way things have changed and the way this technology works.
Right. So this is great. And Disney is making money not just from movie sales, but it's now licensing this technology to other companies too. The competitor that Disney's competitors were previously using, Ultraviolet, was basically a dumpster fire of a hellhole of a terrible product.
Yeah.
Nobody likes Ultraviolet.
I think you're selling it short, actually.
So I don't know. I don't even used it.
Yeah, I actually, when you would buy a physical DVD, and I used to do that, go ahead and laugh at me, you could get the voucher to download it through Ultraviolet. I did it once, and I'm like, screw this. I'll just not do it. I've bought a movie twice so I could have it on iTunes and a DVD.
Huh. Oh, that's so sad. It also occurred to me that I haven't bought a physical Blu-ray or DVD in 4 years, maybe 5 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's the only way to own your stuff.
Is it, though?
I still buy CDs and burn them myself, rip them. I mean, Amazon, they'll let me download it as I buy it. But, you know, 2 days later, a CD's in my mailbox. And this way, it's mine. If Amazon goes out of business next month, it's still mine. It may have only been $10, but it was my $10.
I think you got more than 1 month of runway on Amazon.
Well, an example. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. And, you know, I've probably got close to $100,000 worth of music here. I love music, and I buy CDs every week. And, you know, I still buy music online. I love music. And it would be horrible if, because a company got in financial trouble and had to cut a service, I lost all that. I'm not going to let that happen.
Yeah. I realize I remember 7 Digital. Do you guys have 7 Digital in the States?
I do not remember 7 Digital.
I don't think so. I don't even remember the name.
Yeah, it's a British company, I think, and they launched in Canada. It was basically like an iTunes competitor. And I bought a bunch of cheap CDs on there, and I'm always wondering like when they're going to go out of business. It's interesting, you know.
Well, see, right. If you had physical copies, you wouldn't have to worry about that. Yeah, my only problem is that they're so expensive. I pay $4 to $5 more for the same exact digital data, just it's on a different media, and that bugs me. But then I say, well, they've got to take the labor to create it and distribute it, so I just shut up and do it again.
On the flip side, some books on Amazon Kindle are more expensive than the physical books. So, I don't know.
I gave up my physical books. I have, you know, I still buy them once in a while if I see something. But, man, reading, I use both Google Play Books and Kindle. It's just so great to have, you know, I've got 10,000 books to pick from, man. I don't have to, you know, I can't only fit but one or two in my laptop bag. So, I love it.
How's that new Kindle Oasis, eh?
I don't. I'm not a guy. I don't care about waterproof electronics. number one, none of them, even Samsung is the shining example. They don't honor it. If you try to get a warranty claim because it was water damage, they deny it for water damage. You can go to our forums and see that's just a thing. So the service is useless as far as I'm concerned. And I'm sorry if I offend anybody.
Man.
But I know a lot of people, and you know, I come from South Florida. People love to sit at the beach with their Kindle. And I don't know why. I don't know why that's so popular. But if you would go, you know, to somewhere like South Beach, where I couldn't live, but I could certainly drive there and look, you'd see probably, you know, five or six people as you would walk down the beach were sitting on a lawn chair in the sand reading their Kindle. And that's great for them. They don't have to worry about dropping it. So it's worth the extra $60.
Is it? It's like $250, which is not cheap for a Kindle.
No. You can get a Paperwhite, I think the original one, for like $70 now.
Yeah.
But this is a little more beefier than a Paperwhite. It has a bigger battery. You know, I'm not going to begrudge Amazon for charging a premium for it unless they don't honor people that have problems and it got wet. Then screw you, Amazon.
So there was one thing that I didn't mention about Movies Anywhere. It's that if you sign up now and you hook two of your accounts, so iTunes and Google Play, or iTunes or Google Play and Amazon Prime Video, you get 5 free movies. And they're not great. They're Big Hero 6, the Lego Movie, Jason Bourne, not the good one, the bad one, the new Ghostbusters film, and the original Ice Age. Not sure how they picked those, but there you go.
See, I never got to see the new Ghostbusters. So
yeah, so I found this actually at Thrifter. They had mentioned that in their press release, but I hadn't actually noticed which films there were. And Thrifter has a big write up on how to get this, how to redeem it. So let's do our thing. Let's go to Thrifter and let's pick one deal that we all like, because we've been getting really good feedback about this, by the way.
As long as we don't have to like the same thing, I'm good.
Well, I like the best Halloween costume ever, which is a unicorn one piece, or like a unicorn what's that,
like a onesie.
I was like, what's the term for a one piece? It's a unicorn onesie, and this person who's wearing it is drinking a glass of wine and looks so comfortable.
As you do.
I definitely want one. It's interesting. $20.
$8.46 for a multimeter. If you've got a toolbox at home, go there, spend $8, and get a multimeter if you don't have one.
What is a multimeter, Jerry? Tell people.
An electrical tester. And
why would you need it?
Some people need it because they actually use the features to test resistance and amperage and voltage. But if you've got a toolbox in your house, you need one to know if the power's on or not when you're working on something on the wall. And $8, you know, I don't care how, you know, if it's not accurate reading milliamps, I don't care. It's going to tell you on or off, and it's only $8.
That's pretty good.
Yep.
What about you, Andrew?
Xbox One S wireless controller, $37. I only have one controller and I need another one.
Hey, do those work on the PC?
I believe they do. Yeah, I've plugged mine in, micro USB, but yeah, you can plug it in and use it on the PC as well. I use it for remote play of my Xbox from my PC.
Yeah, and but
those are the kind of things where, like, the controller, you know, the Xbox One S has been out for a long time and the controllers just don't come down in price.
Oh, yeah, it has Bluetooth and connects to Windows 10.
Oh, I've only ever done it wired. But
I might buy that. I like the PlayStation 3 controller best of all of them, but
whatever.
It's a pain in the butt. It doesn't like to stay connected, and you have to fiddle with it.
The Xbox controller will go really well with the discounted Deus Ex Mankind Divided that is currently available, that I'm basically about to buy. It's $20.
And, It got panned, but
no. This is the good one. This is the one that Mankind came out Divided? Last year.
Yeah, I got in on the beta of that. That was cool.
It's 83% Metacritic.
See, I don't have to buy it. I already have it. Now I'll have to find something else to spend my money on.
Well, there's no shortage. Anyway.
10 port USB wall charger.
That's a good one.
Man, I come here and all I do is spend money.
I could buy like 3 or 4 of those and maybe charge up some of my phones.
So one thing that Thrifter added in the last few days, which I really like, is this TLDR. So at the beginning of every deal, there's a "Is this deal for me?" link. And what it does is just takes you right to the bottom so you can read really quickly what makes the deal worth considering. I'm on the verge of buying a Logitech MX Anywhere 2S mouse because it's awesome and everybody says it's the best.
I have one right here in my hand. It's good.
And it's available for $44. And if you click on that link at the top of the deal, "Is this deal for me?" takes you right to why the deal is worth considering and the things you need to know before you buy. I'm sorry, it's $60. The original is $40. So if you're interested in finding out about these deals, about any others, and about getting all of the best deals in your inbox every morning, hit up thrifter.com and sign up for the daily newsletter, and you will be better for it.
I got a 55-inch 4K Roku TV for $400.
All right, that's enough. We're spending too much money.
Well, I think you guys know I'm currently in the market for a 4K TV, and the one I bought conked out, and there was none left to replace it with, so I had to get my money back.
Hmm. Was that the Vizio?
No, it was Samsung, and that's not knocking Samsung. Everybody makes products that fail once in a while, and on the good side, it was so popular I couldn't find a replacement. So I'm not complaining about Samsung. I just complaining about the store I bought it at that should have had another one in the back, damn it.
All right, let's move on to the last topic of the day. It's Pixel versus Pixel 2. Deathmatch. Okay, Andrew, so you wrote this thing today about whether you should buy your Pixel 2 or Pixel 2 XL on Project Fi. And because of the eSIM embedded in the Pixel 2, it's becoming much easier to just sign up for Fi if you're in the U.S. Tell us, what are the advantages of buying a Pixel 2 on Fi or even just buying a Pixel 2 and setting it up on Fi later?
Yeah, so I think that's the first important part is that you could buy it from the Google store and still use it on Fi later. But obviously, you have the extra synergy if you buy it directly from Fi and it's already got your account associated with it and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I was talking to Jerry about this a little bit because, you know, I realized that there aren't a lot of phones that people could have bought and used on Fi. I mean, unless you brought an old Nexus 5X, 6P, or, you know, you bought one of the expensive first Pixels, you know, you've probably been hearing a lot of people talk about Fi for 2 years, and you weren't going to switch carriers, you know, to get an older phone or something like that. A lot of people might be giving it a try, and I think you should give it a try if you're only have one line, or you have potentially two lines, because it can make sense. But if you also don't use that much data, I think is the big one. And Jerry and I talk about this all the time. You know, if you use more than 3 or 4 gigabytes of data on average, Project Fi is probably not going to make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah.
But if you use less than that, if you're like Jerry and I, where you know, you regularly, you know, you may have higher months and lower months, but you average out around 2 to 3 gigabytes at the most. Project Fi makes a whole lot of sense in, you know, when you add in the Wi-Fi features and all that kind of stuff, you know, and you kind of change your behavior just a little bit, perhaps, to get away from that unlimited mindset. You could save a lot of money by going to Project Fi. And if you do, you get all these awesome benefits of great international roaming, which I use dozens of times a year when I go international. You just, you know, you turn off airplane mode when you land and your phone just works. You don't have to pre-set up a plan. You don't have to pay extra. You don't have to deal with, you know, free, quote unquote, unlimited roaming from T-Mobile that's, you know, 128K. You know, you don't have to deal with any of that kind of stuff. You just use it. And at the same time, you get good coverage in the U.S. with, you know, Sprint, T-Mobile, and U.S. Cellular. And the simplicity of billing is amazing. You don't have to deal with, I mean, I have a T-Mobile line as well. And for as Un-carrier and great as they are, it's still, you know, you get a bill and then you set up a payment and, you know, they have these different things and your bill is like a million pages. You know, Project Fi is not like that. It's just, it's all automatic. You can change your plan at any time. Nobody cares. There's not even really a plan, so to speak. You just change the amount of data that you think you're going to use. You can add and remove people from your group plan at any time. You can add additional data-only SIMs with no additional monthly access fee. You know, all this kind of stuff just is so simple, and it's amazing, and I wish that more people could use it. But I do think that if you're getting a Pixel 2 or 2 XL, you got to at least look at it.
You have to sign up. It's going to cost you $20 for a month. If you don't use any data, it's $20 plus $10 a gig. But at the end of the month, you suspend your service. It's still active. You still have your phone number. You're still good to go. I believe you still get an invoice for $0 every month. But with a text, you can get it turned back on that quick. And, you know, if you're going to Canada or Mexico or flying in a plane to Europe.
You turn it back on the Fi app, actually.
Yeah. And there you have... And it costs you $20 plus $10 a gig everywhere in the world. And the phones that do work on Project Fi also happen to get really good LTE everywhere in the world. So you're not stuck with slow speeds. And you may never use it. But if you already bought the Pixel, you're crazy not to have it set up just in case.
Yeah, I think that, well, last time that I dealt with pausing Project Fi was, I think you can pause it for 90 days consecutively, maybe 60 days before you have to re-enable it, you know, for one day or whatever. And the nice thing about pausing is it just, you don't get billed at all. It's all completely prorated out, you know, by the day, by the hour, yes. Kind of just like as data is. So I think the only question for a lot of people is, you know, there's still this Google Voice thing. If you have a Google Voice account, you can't run that side by side with Project Fi. It has to take over your, it'll take it and that's it. And remember at that point, as I figured out, if you pause your Project Fi service, your Google Voice number no longer works at all. So you can't like pause your Project Fi service on your Pixel and continue to have your Google Voice number forward to other numbers. No. It doesn't work like that.
The only thing you can do is open another Google account and get Project Fi through that account. But then you have to deal with the hassle of most of your important stuff comes in on one account, but then part of it comes in on another with a different phone number.
Yeah. I don't think that that's worth it at that point. The bigger thing to do is, and really the nice thing about Project Fi is that it's so nicely integrated with your Google account. You know, it uses the Google payment system just like the Play Store, and it uses your Gmail account to, you know, move the service between devices. You know, I have multiple devices with Project Fi SIMs in them, and I can just open the Fi app and say, this is my phone now. And 10 seconds later, it has my phone number and it has service and the other one's turned off. You know, that kind of stuff being all connected to one main account is fantastic. So especially if you don't have a Google Voice account, it's really worth giving a try. I would definitely recommend it to anyone. You're already buying the Pixel. You're already, you know, most of the way there.
And don't forget the data only SIMs. I have one account at Google Fi, and I have my phone, and I have my LG Watch Sport and my wife's iPad. They're all under my account, and I don't pay any extra device fees. I pay for the megabyte of data that's used.
So I heard a rumor that using an app called Signal Spy, it's possible to force your Fi phone onto either T-Mobile or Sprint.
Yep.
I use that app every day because I switch to Sprint for some unknown reason, and I force it back to U.S. Cellular because their network is amazing here.
Oh, it's also U.S. Cellular, right? I forgot about that.
And
so, I've used it really before helpful. As well.
Tap a button.
Yeah. And also, that's that app, just for network geeks like me, it tells you what band you're connected to. I found that out yesterday. I have always wanted to know, and every app I've tried needed root to get that information. Somehow Signal Spy doesn't need root.
I featured it on our site when it first came out, and I talked to the developer, and he had to work closely with Google over the name and some of the ways he does things, because it used to say, I think it used to be named FiSpy. And you know, Google got in touch with them, and they worked some stuff out, but it's a great app.
Yeah, it's very cool.
You can also suspend it without a notification in Android Oreo for people that hate that. You can push it to the background and not have the notification up at the top. Or you can just shut it off, of course, when you're finished. But yeah, I use that app every day when I wake up.
That's great. Yeah, it's really helpful. So last thing, Andrew, tell me, is it worth buying a Pixel in a world of Pixel 2?
Oh, man. This is the biggest thing, because we didn't expect Google to continue to sell the original Pixel. We kind of expected maybe Verizon would sell it for a little while, clear out some stock. We figured Google didn't necessarily have that much stock laying around because of all their issues selling it. I think that the original Pixel is a pretty good deal. I'm not so sure about the XL. I think the interesting question is, should you buy an original Pixel from Google or Verizon, or, you know, buy one new in box from like eBay or Amazon resellers or something like that? Yeah. Because when we talked about this on the site and a couple different articles, people were saying, oh, well, I just picked up a brand new Pixel 2 XL, you know, new in box from eBay for $399 or something. And I think at that price, it's amazing.
Yeah, that's going to end, though, because Google will give you $400. So nobody's going to sell it for under $400, unfortunately.
I think at that trade-in price, it's a really good price. So that's around, you know, $350 to $450 for the Pixel and Pixel XL. I think that's a really good price. And in the last week, I've been using the Pixel XL, and still a really good phone. Has a headphone jack, really nice. It has all the same issues that it did before in terms of kind of lackluster hardware design, and the screen is kind of meh. But great experience. And, you know, Oreo is kind of, I know you had some issues with it, Daniel, as well. I just factory reset mine, because it seems like a lot of people that came from the beta channel to the stable channel have issues. But I think once you get rid of all that cruft, I mean, the thing has still got plenty of life in it. As far as software updates, we know it has another year of platform and 2 years of security updates too.
Right. Yeah, I think if you can find a Pixel XL for a good price, it's probably going to be a better deal than any other used phone on the market.
Yes.
And I will stand by its design. I know a lot of people don't love it, but it's held up really well over the last year. And I agree. I had an issue going from the public beta to the production software, and I reset my phone this morning. So I'll give you an update next week on how my Pixel XL is running, unless I've abandoned it for the Pixel 2 XL by then, if I can get one. But
well, I know everybody that I've talked to that was on the beta and just let it update without wiping is having problems. So if you're having problems, just reset. I mean, Google tried.
I hate when that's the answer, but it is.
Well,
in
this case, I mean, you got to use a beta. You're lucky they even tried. They could have just said it's over. If you want more, you have to go back to the stable track.
True. Yeah, we've been living that beta life for months.
I'm going to keep using my original 2016 Pixel, the little one. I've got a Pixel 2 coming, and I hope it's a great phone, but I just like the – it's already set up the way I like it. I don't hate the design. It works. I don't really necessarily
care. What a compliment.
Care. Well, I don't care how beautiful my phone is. I do understand some people do. I care that my phone fits in my pocket. The keyboard does not lag. That's why, man, Samsung makes some beautiful stuff. But every phone I've had, including this S8 Plus, I type faster than that keyboard, and I hate it.
Yeah.
The Pixel doesn't, I guess, because it's not doing anything. It doesn't have all the extras and features.
And yeah, it's Google is just so extra.
And
did I use that right?
Yeah, it was good enough. Yeah.
I asked a millennial yesterday, how do you use extra in a sentence? And she told me, and it was enlightening. I feel younger already.
And
just made me feel older. I don't know about you.
I can plug my headphones into it. I like my headphones.
Okay.
I don't want to switch headphones.
Last thing, and then we'll sign off because I have feelings about something. So Jerry, we were talking about AptX and AptX HD, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to look for wireless headphones that support AptX HD. And I found a couple from LG.
Yes.
And they have this line of tone neck buds, essentially. And the first gen neck buds, they were given to everybody like 3 years ago, right? For the LG G4 event or LG G5. And I had one lying around and I never liked it. I couldn't get a good fit. But I picked up these new ones. They're brand new, 2017. They're called the Tone Infinim. And they are they're a revelation. I am in love with neck buds, and I want to spend the entire podcast next week talking about neck buds.
It should just be you and Russell just talking to each other about how great buds are.
I have to admit, I've never used a pair of neck buds. I like over-the-ear headphones. And
every single delivery driver in Seattle wears neck buds. It's just kind of the standard UPS guy outfit.
Yeah, it's the same here. I think that's, you know, they probably give you one when you sign in the morning and punch your time card.
Yeah, I've never had a good experience. I've never had a good fit, but I've been wearing them almost like for 4 days in a row, basically. I haven't used any other headphones, and they're wonderful.
What else did you run across that has AptX HD that might be over the ear and something more suitable for an old man?
That's
the problem. I am and listening to this. If you can find it, email us. I'm looking for a pair of headphones that supports AptX HD, and of course it'll be backwards compatible, and the new codec from Sony LDAC, and the same set of LDAC headphones, because that needs tested. Somebody has to compare those two and see which one does it better, and I cannot find a single pair of headphones except for a super expensive pair that I don't want to spend that much money on a pair of Bluetooth headphones. We're talking $500.
Yeah, nor should you. All right, well, we're going to leave it there for this week because neck buds can push us into the third hour, folks. It's dangerous territory.
And fourth and fifth.
And Andrew's got to cough a storm, I have no doubt. So thank you so much for joining us, Andrew, Jerry.
Of course.
Thank you for listening out there in the world. And we will see you next week. Goodbye.
Neck Bud Central signing out.
Bye.